We often get told that when we're struggling with our own thoughts to pick up the phone and call a helpline. But is that actually the way you want to get support? A new study has found a lot of men are struggling to ask for help and that most of them really don't want to talk about their mental health over the phone. That's coming up. Hey, I'm Isabella Higgins with you for the next half hour on Hack. First off, we're heading across the ditch because our friends in New Zealand are getting ready for a big vote on whether to legalise weed.
Hack. Are we really willing to gamble the next generation of New Zealanders so that a few people can get high on the weed?
On Triple J.
Look, I realise we start well after 4:20, but focus for a minute because you're going to want to hear this. In just a few weeks from now, New Zealand is going to vote on whether to keep Jacinda Ardern as PM, but also on whether weed should be legal. The vote was part of a deal the Greens did with Labor at the last election, and now it's all coming to a head. At this point, it's not clear which way the polls will go. Stephen Stockwell takes a look.
I've been doing stories about weed since well before I came to work at Hack, and there's this guy that I spoke to about 15 years ago who I often find myself thinking about.
Dak is our nickname in New Zealand for cannabis. We don't smoke weed, we don't smoke J's, we smoke Dak. So I have renamed myself and I'm Dak the Green.
I spoke to Dakta in the mid-2000s because he'd opened this cannabis club in Auckland, the Daktory, a place where, once you were a member, you could just visit whenever.
The moment you walk in, you couldn't help but be impacted by the sense of calm and the warmness of it. And then you had a choice. You either brought out your own buds or you purchased them from the club. And then, usually, sit down and enjoy.
Now, this is illegal, which is why Dakta keeps getting arrested and why the Daktory isn't open right now. But there's a vote coming that could change that. On the 17th of October, so in a month from now, while voting on who will run the country next, Kiwis will also be asked whether they want to legalise recreational cannabis. If that vote is successful, anyone over 20 would be able to buy the drug from dispensaries, carry around 14 grams, so half an ounce, and grow a couple of plants at home. No prizes for guessing how Dakta plans to vote.
The reason why we come out, why some of us are coming out, is to show the general population that we are not evil people and that it is time to stop locking us up.
And while Dakta's keen for legalisation, he's not sold on the government's current plan. He thinks that the cannabis age should be the same as the drinking age, so 18. And he doesn't want big companies selling it. He thinks that not-for-profits like the Daktory should be the ones who get to do that.
The moment you start talking to the 500,000 people that are part of the cannabis culture, you'll start getting some rules and regulations that actually make some sense that might work in the community. Because if you people go on making stupid rules, then we've spent decades breaking the law. You don't think that that's going to continue?
Dakta has an important voice and has had an important voice for a long time. But it isn't a voice that undecided voters are going to listen to.
Ross Bell is the executive director of the New Zealand Drug Foundation, and he's keen for people to vote yes as well, although he plays a slightly straighter bat than Dakta does.
Legalisation doesn't invent cannabis. Cannabis is here right now. It's been with us for a long time, and we've simply ceded control of cannabis to the criminal black market, and that's not a good idea.
New Zealand smokes a little bit more than we do. 2013 stats show that 15% of men and 8% of women used it there over the last 12 months, compared to about 11.5% of people here. Unlike Dakta, Ross isn't too worried about the commercial approach because there are limits on how big one company can be.
So you can't have more than 20% of the market. If you are going to get a licence, you have to demonstrate that you're bringing economic benefit to communities that have been disadvantaged by prohibition. You have to prove that you're employing people who have been harmed by prohibition, people with criminal convictions. So there's some really neat social justice aspects to the New Zealand law because we've seen some difficulties with some models overseas, and I think we've struck a really nice balance.
Well, for us it's pretty simple. We want a no vote in the referendum.
Aaron Ironside is the spokesperson for the Say Nope to Dope campaign, and look, that's pretty self-explanatory, isn't it?
We have no need in New Zealand of recreational cannabis because it opens Pandora's box and suddenly we have a generation of mental health issues and all kinds of negative effects that flow on from opening up something that frankly needs to be kept with the lid firmly, tightly on.
Those mental health issues that can be caused by cannabis are one of Aaron's concerns. Another is an increase in use, which we saw when Canada legalised in 2018. After that, about 7% more 18 to 24-year-olds used the drug. But a government study also found that people were more likely to admit use after legalisation. There's also money to be made, with one estimate showing New Zealand could raise almost $500 million in cannabis taxes, some of which would be spent on drug addiction and rehab programs. But Aaron's worried that that money will be raised by selling weed to disadvantaged people.
Are we really willing to gamble the next generation of New Zealanders so that a few people can get high on the weekend?
At the moment, the answer to that question seems to be maybe. Most of the recent polls have about 15% of people undecided, with their preference switching between a yes and no vote depending on the poll. But the most recent poll actually had both sides even at 49.5%, with just 1% undecided. Aaron doesn't sound too worried, though.
It's very hard for the yes vote to win because they don't have any real benefit to lay claim to. In fact, my young adult son joked to me the other night and said, "Dad, why don't the yes vote people just admit that at the end of the day, this just comes down to the fact that some people want to get high and not be afraid that anything bad is going to happen to them."
You're listening to Hack on Triple J.
Stephen Stockwell reporting there. And on the text line, some of you seem to think that if that vote gets through, we might have some Aussies moving over to New Zealand. All right, uni stuff coming up now.
Hack. 250 staff at the University of New South Wales will lose their jobs through forced redundancies.
Our protest has a very specific purpose, which is to protest the specific cuts that we perceive in the arts faculty.
And that process is also underway at Sydney University. Protesters today blamed the cuts on the government's university reforms currently before the Senate.
This is our fourth largest export industry. If coal or gas or iron ore were facing this huge hit to their revenue, the government would be there to help with JobKeeper.
The Australian National University has announced hundreds of job losses as it deals with the financial fallout of the COVID-19 pandemic.
So there will be changes in course. We do want to have courses that have more than a couple people in them. You know, if you have a degree that has very few people in it, and it was a really interesting degree 20 years ago, it's probably time to turn it off.
On Triple J.
For months on end, uni campuses around the country have looked like ghost towns, but even when lockdowns lift, there might be a lot less people around. The pandemic is really hurting the bottom line of major universities, and in the last couple of days, RMIT, UNSW and ANU have announced hundreds of staff cuts. Even more jobs are expected to be lost in the coming months, and now the sector is desperate for a lifeline from the government. Ms. Vicky Thompson is the chief executive of the Group of Eight, a coalition of Australia's biggest unis, and she joins us now to discuss the impact of these cuts. Vicky Thompson, thanks for joining us. How are you today?
Great to be with you. Next question, how am I going? It's a complex one.
Bit of a tough day for the university sector. It feels like these announcements around job cuts at universities are never ending at the moment. In the last 24 hours, hundreds from RMIT and ANU. How is the morale amongst people in the sector at the moment?
Look, it's pretty tough. And I accept, obviously, as the university sector does, that it's tough for all of us. You know, we're in this really, we're all, the overused word of unprecedented, but we are in an unprecedented environment. But I think that the issue for our universities is that we do feel that we've been cast aside in a sense. You know, most industry sectors have had some level of support and engagement in relation particularly to their employers. And like every other sector in the country, we've been hit really hard. So just for the Group of Eight universities, which I represent, we're estimating a revenue downfall of around $2 billion just for 2020, and it'll be significantly higher in 2021. But unlike other sectors in the economy, we have not been eligible, for example, for JobKeeper. And in fact, the government changed the rules to ensure that we wouldn't be eligible. And that would have provided potentially a lifeline to mitigate some of the losses that we're now starting to see.
Can we expect more jobs to be lost over the coming years, as you say, as revenues continue to plummet?
That's the concern. And for the universities that I represent, so we are the research-intensive universities, We do around 70% of all research undertaken in Australian universities. And the big concern we've got now on top of the issues we're facing at the moment is our research workforce. So we estimate that there are some 4,000 researchers across the group of eight universities who are currently on contracts which will come to an end between December and March next year that we simply will not be able to renew because we don't have that funding to renew them.
The research that your universities conduct, obviously that's knowledge that's lost to the world if it's not conducted. But does it also mean in the future Australian universities might lose some of their international rankings or standards?
That's a possibility. But I think more importantly than rankings, which are important, don't get me wrong, but I think you've hit the nail on the head, Isabella, when you talk about losing capacity and losing that knowledge. So these researchers, they will go elsewhere. And once you lose them, it's very hard to get them back.
And as you said, the university sector hasn't been eligible to get the government's JobKeeper. Now you're asking the government for some more funding. Are you hopeful that there will be announcements in the October budget?
So what we're saying to government is that clearly this is not sustainable for our universities. If, as I said at the outset, if we've got potential revenue downgrades of, you know, $2 billion and more in 2021. Government has actually acknowledged that that is a problem. They've understood that it's not sustainable and they want universities to undertake research because it's good for the economy. And so we'd certainly hope that that recognition turns into dollars.
And a lot of our audience are probably wondering, these huge cuts at major universities, how will it compromise the quality of education for students?
And that's a fair enough concern, and that is something that is top of mind to our vice-chancellors and our senior management when they're making these really, really tough decisions. And almost ironically, we are anticipating more students, domestic students, coming to our universities in 2021 because universities tend to be counter-cyclical. You know, we are in a recession, and so students, potential students now who may not have thought about university will think, well, I might as well go to university, which is a great thing for them to do. And we want to make sure that when they do come onto our campuses, we can continue to offer exactly what they expect. In the decision-making processes that our universities make, all of these things are put into the mix because what we mustn't do is compromise our teaching quality for our next generation of students. That has to be our number one priority.
And do you think it will likely mean that domestic students have to make up some of that shortfall, pay more for their courses, or, as you said, if there's fewer teachers around, have less time, less contact time with lecturers or tutors?
We certainly wouldn't be advocating that students pay any more than what they're paying now. And in fact, you know, we've put a submission into government on that very point on the latest job ready graduates legislation. You know, we have a fantastic system, as everybody knows, in terms of our HECS system. But we don't need students saddled with any more debt, particularly at this time. So that would not be an option that we'd be looking at.
Vicky Thompson, thank you so much for joining us on Triple J Hack.
Thanks, Isabella.
Hack on Triple J.
And Brian in Sydney, you say, my son's psychologist at UNSW has been retrenched because of the funding cuts and a lack of support for unis. Seems like the government doesn't really care about mental health.
Hack.
And I remember just crying, bawling my eyes out that night. And then that's when I sort of opened up to both my parents.
On Triple J. Do you think we're getting better at talking about mental health? Well, a big study has found that only a quarter of men would reach out for professional help. The study took a big look at men's attitudes towards this stuff, and while it found up to a quarter of them will experience a mental illness, a lot will likely to suffer in silence. Let us know if you've struggled to get the right help and what you think needs to change. Give us a call on 1300 055 36. James Pertill met some young guys who are speaking out.
A lot of people thought of me as that person who was quite confident, upbeat, and I guess I did have a lot of friends in that, but behind closed doors, I was struggling a lot, and then it just got to a point where that really took a toll on myself, and I couldn't even get out of the house to go catch up with mates.
I'm chatting to Jed over Zoom, and one thing is obvious. He comes across as very confident.
Yeah, g'day guys. Jed Zimmer here, 22-year-old from Bendigo here in central Victoria.
But he admits that confidence also masks something, something that he's tried to hide his entire life and only now can talk about.
I couldn't even get out of the house to go catch up with mates or go to footy training because I was absolutely exhausted from, you know, the previous weeks of hiding everything pretty much.
You say you were hiding things. Do you mean you were hiding your anxiety or was it a
particular Yeah, thing? Yep. Yep, absolutely. So it was my anxiety. You put on a brave face because going back to the stereotype and the stigma, a lot of males, you know, they do see it as a sign of weakness and vulnerability to open up. And I just thought, you know, I looked at myself as a, you know, a strong, brave person. And I thought, look, if I open up about mental health, gee, that's weak, pathetic, whereas in hindsight, it's the complete opposite. So I really did try and hide it for sure.
Jed thought he was alone with his anxiety, but in fact, it's quite common. For young people his age at the time, which was late teens, anxiety is the most commonly reported mental health disorder. It's about 9%. So on a school footy team of 18, probably at least two players are secretly struggling with anxiety. That figure is from a big new survey by the Australian Institute of Family Studies.
And it's a big survey involving almost 16,000 men and boys ranging in age from 10 to 57 years.
Anne Hollins is the head of the Family Studies Institute.
We follow the participants over time and get information about why males on average have poorer health outcomes than females.
What were the most important findings of the study?
Well, this study really highlighted that one in four men will experience a diagnosed mental health disorder in their lifetime. We also found that of all men in this survey sample, when we asked them if they had emotional or personal problems, only 25% of all men said that they would be likely to seek help from a mental health professional.
In many ways, this is a very old story, one we've all heard before. The tough guy keeps their problems bottled up and spirals into loneliness. The more isolated they become, the more anxious or depressed they get. So we've all heard this before. The question is, why is it still happening? It's 2020. Surely we're getting better at this.
Whilst we think many things may have changed in our society, these sorts of stereotypical gender norms are very strong still across society and still form a barrier for men getting the help that they need.
So you're thinking, what about all those phone services, Lifeline and Beyond Blue? Surely men are getting help there. And they are, but nowhere near enough. In the Family Studies Institute survey, 80% of men said they were unlikely to use these kinds of phone services.
I think it's kind of terrifying for a number of reasons.
Russell is the head of advocacy for No to Violence, which runs one of these hotlines, the Men's Referral Service.
It's a perfect storm of people not seeking support, not knowing if they're allowed to seek support, which they are. But ultimately, there's a cultural problem. I grew up in regional Victoria. Half my life my dad was in the army. So I've kind of grown up in these spaces where there is that kind of stigma and shame associated with reaching out for support. So we need to do more to fix that. Like, I've known way too many people who've unfortunately ended their life, and I'm relatively young. So, and I've seen how this stigma is directly correlated with that, and it's really upsetting.
Russell says the key to overcoming stigma is empathy. Jed was terrified of what his friends and family would think of him. But that also meant these people were in the best position to show some empathy, to encourage him to open up and share his problems.
It just felt for me like that was a sign of weakness, which is exactly not what I wanted at that time, especially when you're a teenage male. You feel like you need all positivity surrounding your name.
18 months ago, Jed's secret social anxiety finally got too much for him. He was unable to leave the house or see friends. One night, he just started crying and couldn't stop.
And I remember just crying, bawling my eyes out that night, and that's when I sort of opened up to both my parents. And again, like, that was something that I haven't even opened up to them about to this point. I didn't want to show them that I was struggling. So I got mum in and I pretty much just laid it all on the line, told her exactly how I was feeling.
And as awful as that moment was, it was also the beginning of his recovery. He began seeing a psychologist and also opened up to his friends.
I guess just everything was onwards and upwards from there. And that's the thing, you find that a lot of people actually do go through the same issues that you might yourself and facing the same battle. So if you can both open up to one another, then you'll both help each other. So the more that you do have that conversation, the easier it'll get for not only yourself, but everyone.
Hack on Triple J.
James Patil reporting there. And on the line, we have Lewis from Bundaberg, who went through his own struggles to get help. Lewis, how are you today?
Yeah, good, thanks. How are you?
Yeah, good. Tell us a little bit about how you managed to get the help that you needed.
So it sort of started with, I opened up to my wife at one point and basically admitted struggling, or long-term struggle with alcoholism. And it basically led to me seeking out some help. But it took a little while until that was, it actually was worthwhile. Like, I had to find the right GP that understood where I was coming from, and then subsequently the right psychologist that understood the position that I was in as well.
So it can be quite a long journey to get what you need.
And, you know, I'd tried psychologists and that sort of thing before, and psychologists, and didn't really level with them. So it definitely did take a very long time to actually get to that point.
And are you feeling better now after going through that journey?
Yeah, 100%. And probably the most frustrating thing coming out the other end of it is, I've got a young family. I wanted to go and get some, you know, life and TPD insurance. And, you know, completely healthy guy. Don't smoke. I have an occasional drink every now and then with friends or family. But I can't get insurance, life insurance.
Well, Lewis, thank you so much for sharing your story with us, and all the best.
Thanks.
Well, for more on this and to help us understand this really important issue, we have clinical psychologist and director of mental health training at Movember, Dr. Zach Seidler, who joins us now. Zach, how are you?
I'm good, thanks, Isabella.
Now, first of all, the results of this major study showing that many men are still uncomfortable getting professional help, does that surprise you at all?
No, the report is not telling us anything we don't already know. It's really reinforcing the state of play that is, we are in a men's mental health crisis, and it's actually being compounded, as we know, by this whole COVID-19 situation that we're in. We need to start to make the changes in order to reap the benefits, because these statistics are just going to get worse over time.
And do you see in your work much of a generational gap? Do you see that younger men, I mean, we heard that some really did have struggled to speak out, but do you see a difference between the younger and the older generations?
I definitely think that there is a shift taking place over time. What we're seeing is a bit of a gender reckoning at the moment, where men, young guys especially, are having to focus and face their masculinity and question it and ask what it means. And, you know, that type of woke 21st century man is starting to grapple with this stuff. But what that means is that they're left in a kind of teething phase where the old masculinity of being stoic strength, you know, and power and patriarchy really is coming up against the being vulnerable, open and, you know, in touch with your emotions, which it's difficult, and we aren't providing them with a roadmap to get through that process.
And this really stuck out at me from that report, that often we encourage people to use telephone helplines, but a lot of men said they don't feel comfortable doing that. Do you think we need to rethink our national strategy in that way?
There's a really big emphasis on the fact that men really like confidentiality. They really want to do, you know, anonymous phone lines and online therapy. We're actually not finding that to be the case. As you said before, they don't call up to Lifeline or Beyond Blue as often as women either. So what we know is that more men are seeking help through traditional means than ever before. We need to focus on that, but we need to make the access easier. We need to reduce those barriers. We need to get GPs, you know, linking up with psychologists and finding ways to get these guys over those hurdles, because if we're promising men that this is a panacea when we tell them to seek help, we need to make sure that it actually is going to hold them, it's going to engage them, it's going to respect what they're going through, rather than let them slip through the cracks when they've already overcome so much.
Mm, and Tom on the text line says, as a 27-year-old tradie, it took me years of depression to take the step to be brave enough to seek professional help and eventually get on medication. I can't recommend it enough. And Dr. Seidler, we heard that it can be really tough for people to find the right help. Is that a common experience? You find that it takes people a little while to get on the right track once they do reach out for help?
Hugely. And I would recommend, you know, as a clinical psychologist, I see lots of people and it doesn't mesh sometimes. Sometimes we don't get along. Sometimes I'm not the right fit, and that's completely fine. And I try to make that really clear from the outset that it is a journey and it's not going to work out straight away. There's no magic pill for this stuff. We have to live with our mental health issues, you know, ongoing for a number of years. And it's just a matter of finding ways to self-betterment and self-management. And that's what a lot of guys are seeking. So I want to stress to everyone out there that it's definitely a battle sometimes, but it really does pay off.
Mm, and in your personal opinion, if you are struggling, what is the best first step?
Speaking to your parents or your loved ones, and in any way that you know feels comfortable to you. Suggesting that men need to speak in the same way as women or other people, we need to be able to express our emotions in whatever way they see fit so that we can provide that inroad to intervention. And so definitely speaking firstly with a family member and then going and seeing your GP, who is the gatekeeper for this stuff, and then linking onto a mental health professional, because it's really going to be very useful for you to type and the skills that are going to get you to the point of self-betterment, really.
Dr. Seidler, thank you so much for your time today.
Cheers, Isabel.
And on the text line, this story is even making me want to start getting help. If you do want to reach out to Lifeline, you can get onto them at 13 11 14, and they do have an online chatting service if you're more interested in that.
Hack. Emissions are harder to get down outside the electricity grid. That's in industry, agriculture, transport.
On Triple J.
All right, this week we've been talking about electricity heaps. That's because the government's been spruiking its new energy strategy. But where do you think our electricity should come from? At the moment, about 80% of our power comes from fossil fuels and 20% from renewables. This week, the PM announced the government will be investing more in gas, a fossil fuel, opening up new gas fields, pipelines, and maybe even building a new gas-fired power station. Today, he's also unveiled a new plan for the renewable sector. It would see less investment in solar and wind and more of a focus on hydrogen and carbon capture. To give us his thoughts, we're joined by Richie Merzian, the Energy Director of the Australia Institute. Richie, thank you very much for joining us on Hack. First of all, what did you think of the renewable strategy released today?
Look, the PM announced support for the government's renewable funding agencies, which is good, but there's a catch. It's actually a cut in the level of funding, the lowest levels of funding that they've gotten to date, less than under Abbott, less than under Turnbull. And it has to do more things with less, and that includes backing technologies that have been used to market fossil fuels, and that's specifically this carbon capture and storage technology to bury emissions underground forever, which means that you can keep burning coal and gas. But the problem is it hasn't worked. The government has spent over $1.3 billion and they've got very little to show for it. And now we're forcing our renewable organisations to back it. And that just doesn't stack up.
And why? Talk us through this greater investment in hydrogen. What is the appeal of that technology?
So hydrogen can be made a number of ways. The cleanest way is to use electrolysis and water and power that entire process by renewable energy, and then you get a fuel that has zero emissions when you burn it. So it's a fully clean process, and you can use hydrogen for cars, you can use it to make electricity. It can be a really useful fuel because you can also export it as well. But the problem is how you make it. There's a clean way and then there's a dirty way. The dirty way is making hydrogen using coal and gas, and that can be highly emissions intensive. Now, the Prime Minister's announcement today is actually for both, and that's the real worry, because it's cheaper to make hydrogen the dirty way, so there's a real risk that we might go down the path of locking in a dirty hydrogen industry instead of using this money to build a clean hydrogen, a green hydrogen future, which could go on, you know, indefinitely.
And the PM said solar and wind, those industries were already viable and they didn't need funding. What do you make of that argument?
It just depends on the day of the week you ask the Prime Minister. Today he's talking about renewables, so he's talking about how we need to be tech neutral and not back in renewables anymore. And then 2 days ago, we have a much older, maturer technology, which is gas, and he wants the government to stump up money for a new gas-fired power station. What we need is a consistent climate and energy policy, an approach that doesn't rely on fossil fuels, which are the cause of climate change, and instead backs clean, green fuels. That's the kind of approach that New Zealand, the UK, so many others have taken, because there's no point in addressing the COVID-19 crisis if we're only going to make the climate crisis worse. So that's why we want to see this entire funding package be dedicated just to green, clean, renewable energies.
And the renewable energies strategy announced today, how does that compare to the sort of investment we were seeing announced in the gas sector earlier this week?
Well, their renewable package is more funding, but it's really just to keep the status quo going. If we look at the entire package, all the funding that's been given over the last two decades, fossil fuels has been the major beneficiary. We really do put a lot of our efforts into continuing Australia's reliance and support of fossil fuels. And unless we start turning this ship around, Australia will remain one of the world's largest polluters and one of the top three largest exporters of the main problem towards climate change.
Richie Merzian, thank you so much for joining us on Hack today.
My pleasure, Isabella.
Hack on Triple J.
Thanks so much for joining us on the Hack podcast. We'll catch you on the next one.